I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Well, this is it, the final episode of Buried Truths Season 2, the story of A.C. Hall. Now, of course, if new information comes our way, we may update you with an additional episode, but for now, we're going to finish in a unique way with Buried Truths Live. It was an evening that we held back in May of 2019, and we've now broken it up into two episodes of about 30 minutes each. We just felt this would be an easier way for you to listen. In any case, Buried Truths Live was held over at the Morehouse School of Medicine, and we started off the evening with a recap. The fact that A.R. King would seek to investigate the death of any black teenager was front page news. That he was inquiring into the shooting by two white police officers, well, that was nothing short of astonishing.
But it was gray and white, little bitty house, but it was pretty. I remember she loved that house.
The work that Bill Randall did, phenomenal. It was our finest hour. And I'll say it today.
What did you do? What did you holler?
I hollered, they done killed AC.
They done killed AC.
That's right.
I know one question my students are asking is, when that happened and when you said that's him, did you have any idea that the police would just start shooting, you know?
Heavens no. Why would I?
So it is a fair conclusion then, is it not, that the bullet entered from the back and was apparently discharged through the front of the body.
That's right.
And the common phrase that police officers use?
It is better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6.
But now, there was something I needed to tell Kenny Durden. Something he didn't know. And it concerned that report from the medical examiner.
Was when the medical examiner came in with his report, and it showed that the young man had been shot right in the back. Ugh.
We, the jurors, aforesaid upon our oaths, in our opinion, it was murder.
Hey, this is what we were working for in the 60s, all right?
Since,
so these are dreams coming true.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And if you... What we now know is this. Eloise Franklin gave this boy to Curly Hall, who had lost her only son. She gave him to Curly Hall to now raise as her own. I'm going to let student Aaron Okindo deliver the benediction for this season of Buried Truths.
So last night when I was at the site of his death on First Street in Ash, because I felt like I'm here because he died. But now being at the gravesite, it's like I'm here because he lived. And that is something that I feel like it does him a little bit of justice.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. One of the first things we did at Barry Trues Live was pull back the curtain a little bit. We wanted to talk about how the show came together. So senior producer Dave Barriswain and I went onto the stage where we were interviewed by the co-executive producer, J.Ann Barry.
To kick things off, I want to ask you, Hank, when you first heard of A.C. Hall, what drew you to his story in particular?
I guess it was because even though we began the Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory, even before the name Trayvon Martin ever surfaced in the news, by the time I was choosing the course that I would teach in the fall of 2016, I guess it was, I came to know the A.C. Hall case. And I had been gathering string on it and gathering records on it. I had, and it just struck me as too similar to today. And that I thought, did we do something so wrong back in 1962? That we could have influenced and failed to influence the way that we handle these cases today? There were so many unfortunate shootings of young black men by white police officers. I thought that I don't know where the story is going to go, but it will resonate somehow or other, and we'll find the story. The students will find the story.
So one thing, as listeners to the podcast, from the very beginning, we have A.C. Hall's picture. It's part of the cover art that we've developed. But that wasn't the case when you first heard of A.C. Hall. Can you tell us about that process?
The photograph
was
strictly going through hours and hours of microfilm. And the Macon News and Macon Telegraph are not easily available on microfilm unless you go to Macon. And then one of the newspapers, the microfilm, is at the library at Mercer. The other newspaper is in the microfilm at the Washington Memorial Library, Macon. So I had to go back and forth, and finally I came across, it's interesting, back in those days, and a newspaper like the Macon Telegraph, obviously a white-owned newspaper, but wanting to serve the black community in some way, frankly, because there was revenue to be gained in the black community, they would take a page in the paper that they delivered to the white neighborhoods, but for the black neighborhoods, they would replate it. They would put different information on it, and so they would do news of our Negro neighbors. And I went to that page inside the Macon News, and there was the obituary on A.C. Hall, which led me to names of his family.
And this question is for both of you. There were differences between Isaiah Nixon, season one, right, and A.C. Hall, season two, both civil rights cold cases. But can you talk about some of the key differences in who you were able to find that impacted how you ended up telling the story?
I think with season one, we had a great, I want to call her the protagonist, really. Dorothy Nixon, you know, really guided us as a witness to the crime and then throughout the podcast. But we were limited in season two. You know, we didn't have that A.C. Hall family member. You know, as Hank said at the end of the episode nine, you know, there's no family with a photo of A.C. Hall's image. So we had to find people that remembered him. We had to find people that knew, in the case of this infamous case of the date, people who knew and understood Eloise Franklin and her motivations as well. So that was the big thing. Of course, we had FBI documents, a lot of FBI documents for season one, but we were guided mostly in season two by the coroner's inquest.
Right, we found like zero federal records, zero on this case. There's no evidence the FBI really looked into it, and if they did, we've never located the records.
There's one part in that coroner's inquest where maybe it was Howard Moore, or I think it was, where they said, okay, the record of this shooting, where can I find the record of this shooting? Mm-hmm. And they went line by line on how you would find all the police records of the shooting that night. But all those records are gone. And it's just records that can't be found anymore. And so to have that coroner's inquest document was gold.
Now, to understand this next part, you need to know that we had visuals on stage that evening. and one of them was a photo of a reporter's notebook, the notebook of Tresvant Anderson. Here again is J.N. Barry.
That's right.
And the other image is of the reporter's notes. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that one line, mother weeping,
yes,
have added to the telling of the story?
Now, those of you who listened to season one of the podcast remember what an important role the Pittsburgh Courier played in the Isaiah Nixon case and in raising money for the family. And they reappear in this case because there was a reporter, Tresvant Anderson, who mostly stayed in Georgia doing his reporting for the Courier. And he had a column called Dateline Macon. You can see where his notes correspond to what's going on in the transcript. And you know when he writes, mother weeping, at which point in the dialogue, in the coroner's inquest, Curly Hall started crying. You know, that's a researcher's just dream. It's hard to believe what a phenomenal feeling that is.
And you know, when we find gems like this, you know, really important parts to the story, this part, mother weeping, you know, we've got so much information and we've got to stack it in the right order. And we're like, well, who's going to write this? And we had great help this season.
And may I just take a moment to talk about that? The first season, Dave and I did most of the writing. And the way we describe it, Dave says, you know, we get all the sound assets, whether it's archival sound in season one of Gene Talmadge stomping across the stage, you know, they'll never vote when I'm governor, you know, that sort of thing. Or if it's, you know, an interview with Dorothy Nixon, you know, or whatever it would be, or Keith Johnson apologizing, whatever it is, those are specimen trees, Dave says. We are going to use every bit of those things. Every specimen tree is going to show up in this podcast. We're not going to mow it down. We're going to use it. We just have to find the roads that lead to the specimen trees. And Dave says, I'm going to write the first draft through. I'm going to do the dirt roads, Hank, because you're the writer. I'm not the writer, which he was a terrific writer. He said, and then you're going to come through and you're going to pave the roads. But in this case, because that was an awful lot because the production is so time-consuming, we added a writer, Richard Hallix. Richard is right here. Would you stand up, Richard?
The great and mighty Richard Hallix.
He was magical at taking any complex story and turning it into and assembling it in the order that was comprehensible, that made sense.
What did he say? What was the line he said?
I said, Richard, now the way Dave and I did it, Dave would do the dirt roads, and then I'd come in and I'd pave them. He'd said, Hank, I don't do dirt roads. And he didn't. And so much of what you heard in the second season is as he wrote
it. Absolutely.
Well, thank you for all the work that you did and that everyone who worked on season two of Very Truth did.
That was co-executive producer J.N. Barry in conversation with senior producer Dave Barraswain and me. As you can see, our small team puts a lot of energy into Buried Truths. We have writers, editors, screeners, and production and editing sessions that go on forever. We've got people compiling all that great work from my students at Emory. We've got people doing marketing, grant writing. You can help offset some of these costs by becoming a Buried Truths supporter. Your donation is always welcome at buriedtruths.org. Just click on the link that says Donate to support the show. The link is up toward the top of the page. Again, that's at buriedtruths.org. Another thing we did this evening was share listener comments about season two of Buried Truths. There was this comment, thank you, because so many people don't know the history or the pain it left. Another comment, profound, disturbing, and beautiful all at once. And there were many more, of course. Here's one, a must listen to understand the American history that has not been taught in schools. And we got one more comment that we thought was so interesting that we wanted to reach out to the person who sent it in.
My name is Marcy Kawati, and I am from New Jersey. It was season two that I listened to with my son. at the end of each episode, my son would say some variation of, "Hank really knows how to tell a good story." My son is 12 years old and in seventh grade and has studied American history, but hasn't really started to think about recent American history in terms of North and South, racial divide. And for him, I think this made him realize that these are things that are still going on. As my son and I were listening to the final episode of the season, Hank was talking about his hope that someone would recognize A.C. Hall's birthday. And he mentioned that he had realized that it was unlikely that anyone had a photo of A.C. Hall in a friend or family member's house. And he was talking about his birthday of May the 7th. And my son and I looked at each other and realized that we were listening to those words and that episode on May 7th. And it just made us feel all the more connected to the story. And we agreed that, well, May 7th is now going to be a day that we will always remember because it's A.C. Hall's birthday. And that was also the moment where we said, we've got to email Hank.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org. Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
Okay, so next on stage, we bring up two men who were very instrumental to our understanding of the A.C. Hall case. Now, both Newton Collier and Howard Moore Jr. walk out onto the stage to join me. And my first question is to Newt.
I'm going to ask you, how did you meet Sam and Dave?
That was through Otis Redding.
What?
Otis is from Tyndall Hike also, and so I was with the little group called Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers. Johnny Jenkins, the man that taught Jimi Hendrix how to string his guitar. But he was living in Macon at the time, but I was hanging around with Johnny Jenkins trying to be a musician. And so I guess by me going away and playing around in the neighborhood, Johnny paid attention to me, and Otis did too. So while I was in school, I basically was doing little short jobs here and there. I was in Atlanta. Had a little job at the Peacock one night. They told me to go down and Otis Redding was playing, so I played the Peacock. Wow. Sam and Dave were my next calling.
And then I turned to Howard Moore Jr. I wanted him to tell his version of the story of when the well-known civil rights figure Donald Hollowell asked him to travel to Macon to represent the family of A.C. Hall. As you'll recall from the podcast, Howard Moore was going to Macon instead of Hollowell.
Had something in mind for you that day.
Well, as I walked into the door, he said, "Howard, Carl Sim is going to drive you down to Macon. And here's a volume of the Georgia Code. Take it with you, and you look at the section on coroners. And when you get down to Macon, it's about a boy that was shot by the A.C. Hall, named A.C. Hall, by the police, and his mother will be there." And he walked off. And Carl drove me down to Macon. And so when we got down to Macon and parked the car and got started towards the courthouse, it looks as though there were 3,000 Negroes on the front of the courthouse. As far as you could see, nothing but Negroes. Just black people everywhere. And as I approached, they looked out and saw me, and they exclaimed almost in one voice, 3,000 people voices. It was 1,500 according to the newspaper. "That ain't Hollowell." And so they may have been a little disappointed, somewhat disappointed at Hollowell, but they still parted and allowed me to enter the courtroom. And I went in the courtroom and I sat down and they started calling witnesses. And the first witness up was the medical examiner, and the state's attorney solicited examining him. And then Mr. Denmark Groover, who became, he may have been at the time a member of the Georgia legislature. And this was the first time ever in my lifetime I had examined anyone in a legal proceeding. I had been admitted to the, I had been practicing in Georgia for exactly 2.5 months at the time. You see how old I was? I was old enough not to be married.
Boy, that's a non-answer.
And this is, I was 30 years old.
But after you'd done some questioning and some examining, there was a response from all the blacks up in the balcony. They started saying something to you again. The same people who had said, "That ain't Hollowell." What
are
they saying?
Man, that was something, what they said. You should have been there. All these people, all these black people up there, was hardly breathing space, or breathing air to breathe up in the balcony and such. And it looked like in one voice, they said, "That ain't Hollowell, but it sounds like Hollowell."
And of course, as you know, based on his performance that day and Hollowell's the second day, which was 2 days later, the jurors, the coroner's inquest jurors, who one of, again, Catherine Daughtrick, the researcher, examines the lives of all of them and found that four of them, and they're all white men, four of them had been born in the 1800s. And all five of them voted unanimously that they believed that A.C. Hall had been murdered, that the police had murdered him. I just want to say one more thing, that the first time I met Howard, I was out on the West Coast for something, and I wanted to meet him and talk to him about the A.C. Hall story. And at the time, I did not have the transcript with me. But his memory, I told him I had the transcript and I would send it to him, and he says, "Oh, no." And he had such a bad memory, he was fearful that he hadn't done a very good job, and that it was his first time that he would read the transcript and wince, you know, at what a bad job he did. And then I sent it to him, and I called him a few weeks later and said, "So what'd you think?" He said, "Not bad." If you ever are in Macon, you'll see quickly that Newt Collier is the unelected mayor of Macon, at least downtown. He knows everybody there and all the neighborhoods. And I guess what I'm curious about, when you left Macon and you're on the road and people are talking to you about Macon, and you're traveling in Japan or wherever it is, and people want to know about Macon, what they know about is music, maybe. Right. But were you inclined to paint it as a really glorious town, or did you paint the kind of town that would, where two white cops could kill A.C. Hall and get away with it?
Well, I don't remember saying anything negative about it, but I always told him, you know, that you have to watch yourself when you go there. But music was the focus of the whole thing in making it at that particular time. And it never got to that point. They always wanted to know, where did Little Richard stay? How old is Redding? Where's the nearest joint we can see some of these people, or something like that? That was mostly what they would be asking. They didn't get into too many things like other things than that.
Well, how would you describe it now?
Now that I'm back and looking at it backwards, it's still a mixed city. And the unification is coming, but it's coming slowly. And with the help of Dr. Davis here, he is, to me, a doctor.
Incidentally, Newt Collier is making reference to Sheriff David Davis, who had joined us that evening.
He has put a force together that don't care who you are. If you're wrong, you're wrong. And you've got to go down, he'll take you down. That's what I like about it.
And I'm just curious, when you and I first met and you heard what I was down there for, and you knew this was going to reopen a past,
right, yeah,
about somebody you knew who, I'm just curious, what were your expectations, and how did the outcome compare to your expectations?
My expectations was to not necessarily clear his name, but to make his name real and let people know that didn't know the time and what had happened during that time and where we are today as far as the city is concerned. Mm-hmm.
And if you were to tell us, if you would again, even though I know you do on the podcast, just tell us who A.C. Hall was.
Okay, A.C. Hall, young man, he died 17, but I knew him 15 and 14, and we lived in the Tenderfield area, and he was a single kid, and we played on the playground together. Our common thing was he could come over, across the railroad tracks, and we could all meet on the playground. He would come over, and his thing was he was a little taller than most of us in many ways. He could out-jump us, and he could block shots really good. And I would go over to take him down, but that never happened. But
we only have a couple more minutes. I want to come back to Howard. You told me a story once. I wish I had alerted you I was going to ask this, about going into a clerk's office somewhere trying to get some papers for Hollowell. And you were surprised by the reception that you got. Do you remember that story?
Yes, I remember that story very well. Yeah, Mr. Hollowell dispatched me to some county nearby. And we had to get a paper signed before 5 o'clock. We had to get this paper signed. And so when I got there, the clerk was resistant to accepting the paper. But I was resistant to leaving without filing the paper. And so as I was talking with her about filing the papers, I heard a voice from an inner office call out, is that one of Hollowell's boys? And of course, I was very proud of that. I was definitely one of Hollowell's boys. And I said, yes. And he said, well, send him back here. And so I went back and talked with the fellow, and he says, how's that rascal Hollowell doing? I said, he's running for Superior Court Judge up in Fulton County. He said, hey, shut your mouth. This is 1964. He said, you know, he'll be a good un, but he ain't gonna get it, and you know why. Now, if I have to spell it out for you, your mama wasted her money sending you to that big northern school. And so he said, Mary Lou, I think that was her name, Mary Lou, when he comes out there, go ahead and file these papers. Don't give him a hard time. And so when I went out, she took the papers and she filed them. And then she kind of called me over so as it would be a private conversation between the two of us. And she says to me, tell Mr. Hollowell that I said hello. And for that time and place, that's a remarkable revelation. She doesn't say Colonel Hollowell or Uncle Hollowell. She says Mr. Hollowell. And it's indicative of the respect that Hollowell quietly earned in his practice throughout Georgia.
Outstanding. Thank you both. Again, they'll be back and we'll ask some questions later.
That was Howard Moore Jr., the attorney who represented A.C. Hall's family, and Newton Collier, A.C. Hall's childhood friend. In part two of Barry Truce Live, we start by talking about, we talk about how to move forward. And also we take some really good questions from the audience. Some of those questions were pretty pointed. Remember to sign up for our newsletter. And also remember that your donation is welcome at BarryTruce.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate and thanks.